because we are living in a chemical world, and I'm a chemical nondescript person. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl or boy. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical.
Hi, I'm Kenna Crampton, membership director at KDNK Community Radio. Welcome to Chemical World, a show where we discuss recovery models and evidence-based practices in addiction.
Hi, I'm Maggie Seldin, peer recovery coach at Mind Springs Health, here to tell you that you do not have to be sober to keep your community clean.
Welcome to the second episode of Chemical World. I've got Maggie Seldin here. I'm so happy to be here with you today.
So happy to be here as always.
Great. And we are going to talk today about the history of drug laws and their relationship with the systemic racism in our country.
Yeah, definitely. Kenna, you brought up a really good point last week on our first episode that with everything going on right now in the nation and the world, that it would be poignant and a good starting point, I think, as, you know, the stuff we're talking about here is pretty heavy and it needs a little bit of background context. So, yeah, today I wanted to kind of go over a little bit of the history of our drug laws and make it pretty clear that regardless of your feelings about drug use and your feelings about addiction, that the laws exist for pretty much one reason, maybe two reasons: oppress the poor and make money for the rich. To get us started here on the history of our drug laws in the nation, I think it's important to go back to something that didn't necessarily involve America, but the opium wars between China and Britain. So basically, we have evidence that people were enjoying the opium poppy plant about 30,000 years ago. And then, Kenna, do you know what laudanum is? Have you ever heard of that?
Oh, I do, because my husband watches a lot of Western. So in Tombstone, Wyatt Earp's wife is addicted to.
And does she get it like at the soda fountain?
No, she gets it from her doctor.
Okay.
She's prescribed it.
Yeah, there was some interesting stuff happening in America in the, you know, 1800s for sure, revolving around opium. So laudanum was an opium-based medicinal beverage that was invented in 1524, and it became really popular. And, you know, I think we all know about Coca-Cola and cocaine. And so, yeah, in the 1800s, I believe it was interesting, kind of around the turn of the beginning of feminism, if you think about it from this way. So women were drinking. So and then, too, during Prohibition, in the early 1900s, so women would be drinking these cocaine sodas at the soda fountain. They couldn't drink alcohol, but they could drink cocaine soda. And then they would be acting kind of kooky. And so their doctors would prescribe them opium at night to sleep. So you have a generation or a few generations of these women and men who were using cocaine all day and opium all night. So that was an interesting beginning for us there. Again, going back to that, you know, we talk about, oh, it's not a drug, it's a plant that grows in the ground. I mean, all of our drugs come from plants that grow in the ground. I think aspirin is based off of like a tree bark, like that's the substance. So anyway, going back to the opium wars, so a little bit of background here. So yeah, opium, you know, was being widely used. It became really popular from like the 1100s on. It was largely being produced in India and the Middle East. And basically, it found its way to China through merchants and traders, and it created a huge opium epidemic right away. So, you know, similar to what we've been seeing here, lots of overdose deaths and lots of just lost productivity to people using opium. So China was pissed about that. And I believe in the 1700s, Britain gained control over India's opium crops. And so they really wanted tea from China in England. Tea was a really huge market, but it was all being imported from China. But England didn't really have anything that China wanted. I think that the Chinese were trying to trade with silver, and the English ended up saying that they couldn't because they were trying to like somehow get rid of their other goods. Basically, it was all for this imperialistic economic control over China. Long story short, England gains control over these opium fields in India. They basically dominate the opium market all over the world. And so they want to sell all their opium to China. China is not too pleased about that. And Britain actually ends up going to war with China twice in the 1800s to get them to buy their opium. So I just think that I think it's worth bringing to the table because it's kind of an interesting story of how people's dependency on opium and just its popularity incited these international wars that were all just about economic imperialism and conquest.
And let me see if I got that right. So China was producing the opium.
So now China is one of the number one opium producers. But at the time, it was India.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. Okay. So India is producing the opium and England is buying it from India to sell it to China.
Well, I think what happened there was they, and this, I mean, I'm sure I didn't, you know, I was trying to kind of focus my research, but I'm sure it connects to just colonial expansion in India and Africa that was happening in the 16 and 1700s from the Dutch and, you know, Britain Isles. And so
Britain isn't actually buying it.
No,
from
they can.
India. They're taking it from India to sell.
Okay. Yeah, pretty much. The language is they got control of the opium trade. So, okay. You know, take that however you want. Again, that wasn't the focus of my research. But if you know anything about Britain's history in quote unquote taking over trades, and then, you know, we kind of have taken on that role, I think, here in America. Britain really like reached its fingers out to everywhere and kind of toxified the entire world during those centuries, and now we're kind of picking up footing the bill on the rest of that.
Yeah, I think we are still kind of cleaning up the mess from when our founding fathers decided to make this country what it is and not have to pay taxes to those rich Britons over there where you were doing our own part.
Yeah, and it's funny how much taxation comes into the rest of this conversation. It all goes back to taxation and not wanting to be taxed and not wanting this to be taxed and not wanting that to be taxed. People are really finicky about taxation. Any other probing questions about the opium wars, Kenna?
Well, I did want to just make a quick correlation to when you were talking about laudanum, about the women, how they're taking these drugs during the day and then taking these other drugs at night. And it kind of reminded me of like Mama's Little Helper. And like, so that almost changed from opium to Valium, from cocaine to
methamphetamine?
Yeah, methamphetamine.
Yeah. Sorry, I don't know if that was the word you were looking for.
That was the word I was looking for. It was the amphetamine. Mostly that I was kind of like, because the amphetamine is more a prescribed.
Yeah, amphetamines are like a larger class of stimulants that include methamphetamine. But I mean, and we'll get into a little bit of that in a bit too when we talk about schedules, because it gets really funny there. Oh, but I think the Mama's Little Helper, yeah, you hit the nail on the head. And if you go back and look at how benzodiazepines like Valium were originally marketed, and another thing that you bring up that this reminds me of that's really interesting, most countries it's illegal to advertise pharmaceutical products. Just think about that for a second.
Yeah, because, I mean, I don't watch a lot of TV, and part of that is the commercials that I just can't stand. So I don't watch, like, commercial TV. I'll stream stuff. But if you are watching commercial TV, you'll see at least four commercials in a 30-minute time span about different drugs that you should ask your doctor about.
Yeah, and of course they say ask your doctor about, but I think the idea there and the reason that most countries don't allow it is because, you know, it puts ideas about these drugs into people's head that aren't from their medical professional. And I challenge you to find me one magazine that is directed at women that does not have an antidepressant ad in it.
Well, and I guess I wanted to mention that it just feels like throughout history, we're trying to keep women drugged, poor people drugged. And that's kind of what we're getting at with this episode. But I like how you mentioned the laudanum. You know, women were so under the control of these drugs. So,
Yeah, and that's definitely a theme that we see throughout history. And I wanted to just add, I told Kenna before we started recording that there's no such thing as mispronouncing a word because we all just speak with different dialects. So if somebody tries to get superior with you, just say, that's just the way I say it. Tomato, tomato. Okay, so there's definitely a lot there, especially during Prohibition. I mean, Prohibition was a largely feminist movement because women couldn't divorce their husbands. And so they had no recourse when they were in a violent situation. And so the Prohibition movement was largely driven by women in the sense that it was seeking to protect them from their drunken husbands. And yeah, there was a lot going on at the time with prescribed cocaine and prescribed opium. I want to kind of flash forward to the Harrison Narcotic Act of 1914. So this act, basically, it just mandated that you had to have prescribing authority to give opium or cocaine before you could buy those things over the counter. Now, like, you had to have a doctor's prescription. There's a lot more in there. But for me, what really was a huge driving motivator behind the Harrison Narcotic Act, and this ties back into our thing on the opium wars, was the swell in Chinese and Asian immigrants coming to America and the popularity of opium dens. So opium dens are largely considered like a Chinese influence, and they were social meeting places for people to come and use opium together. And so there was a lot of fear about white women hanging out with Chinese men in these opium dens. And there was a lot of xenophobic fear around, you know, in general, Chinese immigrants coming and taking jobs, just like, you know, we see concerns about that still today, but also just the cultural influence and, you know, how afraid they were. And it's just funny when you look back to the opium wars and the cyclical relationship between China and America and Britain and this whole like battle of opium. It's like first they didn't want it from us and now we're worried about them bringing it here. But ultimately, you know, the opium is there. It's not really, whatever. I won't say it's nobody's fault. But anyway, so and then another component of that narcotic act was, 1914. So, you know, obviously slavery has ended, but there's still a lot of racism. There's still segregation in most of the country. And so there was also rising concerns about the, I can't even use the language that everything will, that if you look this up, it would give you, but basically African Americans being fueled on cocaine and being able to withstand bullets. So it was really this fear of African Americans and Chinese immigrants that fueled a lot of the Harrison Narcotic Act of 1914.
And we can see that today, fear is what drives all of what is going on in our country. I mean, with the police being scared of people of color, and we're enforcing these laws through fear, which I don't think makes a lot of sense. But
yeah, and it's just silly. I mean, I doubt that your neighbor looks exactly like you, you know, and we just need to embrace each other with love and not fear and embrace our differences. But it's difficult to do that because our country is founded on these systematic fears. And something somebody said recently is, you know, you have to look at how pervasive it is because you've been raised in a system that is racist. So we really need to be able to dig deep to identify racism in ourselves and racism in our community sometimes because it is so finely ingrained in us.
Yeah, and you don't realize that you're scared of something just because you've been told it. It almost goes back to what you were saying in the last episode about your idea of meth addicts and what you think about in your head as opposed to what's the reality. Mm-hmm. And I think that plays into this.
It's like the old conversation, like, if you didn't do anything wrong, what do you have to be afraid of? Your gun, your taser, your baton, your power, your unlimited power, and that anyone would believe you over me in a situation.
Yeah, and I think as a woman, we can speak to being scared of people with power over mm-hmm. us.
Yeah, but it is. I mean, I don't know. Part of it is like it's natural to be afraid of things that are different and new. But I mean, you don't like, you're afraid on your first day of school, right? And you go and it's fine and you do it, you know, whether you really like it or not. It's scary, but it's not detrimental to your health. It's not going to hurt you. It's good for you. It's how you learn and grow, is by embracing new and different experiences, you know.
Lean into the fear.
Yeah. Lean into the love.
Lean into the love and the fear. I think embracing things that scare you is such a great point, though. And I like how you bring school. That's a really great point, because I'm always scared of school.
Well, yeah, and I think, I don't know, for some of us, social things are always scary. But, you know, you go, and whether you enjoy it or not, you know, you live. You make it through, usually. All right, so then the next piece of history, and this is where stuff starts getting really juicy. This is like, jump in if you have questions. There's a lot here. So the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, my favorite. So my favorite part is that it didn't actually decriminalize use or possession of marijuana. It just created a tax on marijuana. Again, it's all just about taxes. And so really, before doing my research for today, what I was aware of with the Marijuana Tax Act is the influence from rich guys like William Randolph Hearst and Andrew Mellon. A huge motivating factor behind this act was that the paper companies were really threatened by hemp and the production value of hemp, and that it could. So check this out. So 100 years ago, we knew that there was a way better source for a lot of the stuff we make, and the guys who make the non-sustainable version were so not into that. The guys making paper products were really freaked out about hemp. And again, there is a lot of connection between Latin American immigrants and the Marijuana Tax Act as well. I love it because it's actually spelled with an H, because it was the Spanish word, marijuana. So originally it's an H and not a J, and it's just transitioned over time.
I do have to just break in to mention that you can make paper out of hemp, you can make clothes out of hemp, you can make cardboard, you can make, like, the amount of products that you can make from hemp is very long, and it kind of just, it also just, I have to say, plays into renewable energy resources and how we have also turned our back on those resources as well, for the same reason as why we are not using hemp for paper.
Yeah, we're having all these issues with sustainability, right? And it's like, to me, I don't understand how you could think that, like, removing the layer between the crust of the earth and the core of the earth, like, wouldn't cause problems. Like, that's going to cause problems, right? And there have been more sustainable options for a long time. They're not as profitable, is the problem. And again, another big question, why do we let 1% of the world have all the wealth while a lot of people starve and die in the streets? It just doesn't make sense.
Well, and I feel like it's not profitable for those few rich. It is profitable for the sustainability of the world.
Yeah, it would probably make more jobs too. But anyway, totally. So for those of you who aren't aware, so the marijuana plant has several parts. It has several chemicals in it. You know, THC is the chemical in marijuana that gets you high. CBD is the chemical in marijuana that has a lot of really great medicinal curative properties. So in this day and age, there are a lot of treatments that are just CBD. It's been really successful in epilepsy with children, and there's just been so much good work. I mean, CBD is a miracle. You can get it in an ointment. I mean, you can get it in tinctures. It's expensive because it works. In medicinal marijuana, you get all different kinds of strains, and so you have ones that are higher in CBD. It just depends on what your medical condition is, because it is used in a variety of them. And then there's the hemp plant itself, and that is a very fibrous plant that, yeah, is capable of doing a lot of things. So basically, Hearst and Mellon did not like that, and so they lobbied really hard to get the Marijuana Tax Act. Now also enter into this conversation Harry Anslinger. So Harry Anslinger was the director of the first Federal Bureau of Narcotics, which is the forerunner to the modern DEA, or Drug Enforcement Agency. So he was like the lead of the first Federal Drug Bureau. I didn't know that much about Harry Anslinger, and last week I was actually in a class I was taking for my job and becoming a clinical addictions counselor. There was this little YouTube clip of a Joe Rogan episode where he interviews Johan Hari, and I bought the book that Johann Hari wrote, and it's amazing, but I will say, like, just go watch the 15-minute Joe Rogan clip, because he pretty much explains it all. But so Johann Hari wrote this book called Chasing the Scream about the war on drugs, and he did a really great job of – it's kind of just almost a biography of Harry Anslinger and his involvement, because Harry Anslinger was really racist and really hated addicts. And so coming into this role as director of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, he, of course, like, had some very specific goals. I won't get into this. I really suggest you check out the Joe Rogan episode or his book, but basically Harry Anslinger was responsible for killing Billie Holiday and ruining her life. And when Billie Holiday was an opioid addict that Harry Anslinger was trying to destroy, Judy Garland was also an opioid addict. I mean, we've already kind of addressed why a lot of these women at this time were opium addicts. And I mean, when you were in show business, it was, I think still it's very common, you know, there's just more exposure to stuff like that and you need to find ways to relax, whatever. But so Harry Anslinger's recommendation to Judy Garland for her opium addiction was to take longer vacations, whereas he literally like destroyed Billie Holiday's life. So that's a cool story there.
Can you just real quick touch on what he did to Billie Holiday? Because I'm curious.
Yeah, no, for sure. So so according to Johann Hari, this is where my source for this information. So I guess the first time Billie Holiday ever sang Strange Fruit, which is a song about men being hung in the South for their color, Harry Anslinger went up to her and said, you have to stop singing the song. You can't sing the song in public. Well, she never stopped singing that song, but she had a lot of barriers to even be able to get out and sing at all. And so Harry Anslinger had people following her. You know, he had one of his, he didn't really like to hire African-Americans, but he kind of had to send them into Harlem to follow Billie Holiday around. He just, you know, recommended, I mean, she had a hard life in general. I know that, you know, she was raped at a young age and the guy got 3 months and she got a year, something like that. Like, yeah, it was just crazy back then. And, you know, this is before deinstitutionalization, which is a whole nother issue. But our mental institutions weren't very fit. And now they just, because they were unfit, they released all that population and now they're in the prisons that are unfit. But that's a story for another day.
That sounds like an interesting episode.
Like, he got her cabaret license revoked after she had been in a rehab. She had kept trying to get clean over and over again. She had spent time in hospitals. I mean, rehabs in the 1930s, it really was nothing. It was just cold turkey, you know. And she was on methadone for a while. And actually, from what I understand, in her last day in a hospital, she was on methadone. And then they removed her from the methadone and she died in 3 days. And she died, I think. She died very young. But he, you know, Harry Anslinger, just he hated jazz music. He hated African Americans. He hated addicts. You know, he very much took a moral approach to addiction and thought it was their fault unless it was a white person. And then who knows what he thought. But so where Harry Anslinger comes in with his role in the Marijuana Tax Act is also very interesting, because basically he had said himself that marijuana wasn't a very dangerous drug. He really wanted to get opioid users. Morphine, which is an opiate, was his like enemy since he was a young child. But he was charged with a failing organization. They lost a lot of funding, and there wasn't really a lot of opium abuse at the large scale happening. I mean, the reason why there's so much more focus on opioids right now, Kenna, is because it's affecting white suburban people more now than ever before because of the advent of OxyContin, because it's being prescribed by doctors. That's why we're here talking about it. That's why it's a national epidemic, is because it's affecting rich people. But back then, it wasn't really the huge concern that it is now. And so he had to find some creative way to get funding.
So one reason why overdoses are happening more now also is because the opioids are stronger. I mean, like, laudanum compared to fentanyl, I mean, like, that's a whole different animal, right? Pretty much.
Yeah, and there are just generally more prescription opiate-related deaths generally than, like, heroin. So it's those higher doses and that easier access because it's being normalized. I mean, if you were somebody, I don't know what this is like, but if you were somebody who had no experience with substance abuse or addiction in your life whatsoever, and you went in and got a 14-day prescription for oxys after you got your wisdom teeth removed, that's dangerous, you know? Mm-hmm. You don't even, and you don't know how dangerous it is, so...
You don't know how you're going to react to it.
Well, and a little bit of the history there, too, is that there was, like, basically, like, people weren't prescribing enough for pain, I guess, in the medical community before the 90s. There was this huge issue with, like, we're not treating pain fairly. And, I mean, it's hard because, you know, what they ask you when you go to the ER, what's your pain level from a 1 to a 10? But everyone's scale is different. So it's hard to know what someone else's pain is. And some doctors are mean, but... that was kind of, so now, then we hit this like over prescription, like that we thought we had this miracle drug with OxyContin. And so they just started prescribing it like crazy. And just the whole way that prescription, you know, that big pharma is set up in this country is really scary. But it came from this place of like, we're not treating pain enough to now we're over treating pain with a medication that is very addictive and very unsafe.
And fentanyl is something that you can be prescribed as well, right? I mean, that usually that's where drug dealers are getting their fentanyl it's a prescription, right? It's not like heroin that's being
produced
on the black market.
And I'm not sure where they're getting it. Fentanyl comes in a variety of forms. So that would make sense that they're getting it in pills. It comes in patches too, which is interesting, like a lidocaine patch, which is like a topical anesthetic, but it like... just gives you opiates straight through your skin. So fentanyl is interesting because, as we'll discuss later, it is, you know, more quote unquote medically safe than other opiates. But I've never seen it used in the real world. But I know people who have had prescriptions of it. I know that it is a prescription drug. You can come in lollipops and skin patches. And then I'm assuming pills. And that might be why it is. I don't know all the details there. And that'd be interesting to look into because, you know, usually people cut powdered drugs like heroin or cocaine with all sorts of things. Like they'll cut it with anything that will make it so you can still take it and it still looks like what it's supposed to be.
Baby laxatives.
Right.
And
aspirin.
Baking soda.
I've heard cow bones. You know, yeah. Whatever, like, you crush them up. Whatever, you know, yeah, is going to look like the substance. And so that's kind of like... when they're cutting it, they're just trying to make more money off of the amount that they have. They're selling you less of the drug than you think that you're getting because it's the same weight, right? Because it's cut with something. Fentanyl is weird because, like, you don't want that in your heroin. Like, you cut your heroin with fentanyl and you're very likely to get a hot shot and die because the fentanyl is so much stronger. So maybe they're using fentanyl pills, smashing them up, cutting them with heroin. But so fentanyl, like, when you talk about – this gets weird too because – I read this in books and I'm like, well, that's not what I thought. But so like white China is fentanyl. But like heroin is usually brown or even black. Yeah. Like it looks like tar, black tar heroin, right? So I haven't had the pleasure of seeing fentanyl cut heroin in person. But yeah, it's interesting to me because it's the wrong color.
Interesting.
Yeah. So basically, Harry Anslinger, going back to the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937, he used some crazy hyped up fears, kind of the Reefer Madness era kind of thing. Basically, like, there was a story of a guy who had killed his family after smoking marijuana. And so Harry just grabbed it and, you know, we're going to use this to fund the Federal Narcotic Bureau and created this whole propaganda campaign of against marijuana. But Harry had not been against marijuana in the beginning. No medical doctor was willing to say that it was dangerous. And the guy who the story is based off of, that all that propaganda came out of, was deeply psychotic for a long time before that and had a long family history of mental illness.
So pretty much the pot had absolutely no... like, was not the reason why he killed.
No, not at all. Of course not. I mean, even nowadays you hear about some of the, you know, deaths with marijuana. And there are definitely some concerns of like young kids taking too many edibles because they don't know. But it's not the marijuana that's killing you. It's you are paranoid and freak out or whatever and do some crazy thing. It's not, there's no chemical reaction that's causing you to overdose. But even in those stories, those are so few and far between. And it's because they're not following the labeling. It's because they're using really unsafe amounts of a pretty strong substance there. But yeah, that kid, I mean, marijuana too, it some people have said, because I don't want to say it's been proven because we don't really know. But, you know, some people believe, as studies are coming out more and more, that marijuana can incite psychotic episodes in the already psychotic, but that would be the only role that it had to play in that scenario.
Well, and that kind of brings me back to something that we might have, that we talked about. I think the way that marijuana changes your perspective. And and so a lot of that is just that you didn't realize these psychotic thoughts were going on until you got stoned. No, I don't know if that's necessarily true. But
well, and it's an interesting question in terms of recovery, right? Because I talked last week, too, about how a lot of people here in the Valley don't think about marijuana when they think about recovery and sobriety. But for some people, based on their mental health or their mental health history, it might be better to abstain from marijuana because of the potential psychotic or manic episodes that it could cause. But it just depends on the person, and like they should have a doctor who's evaluating for them for that and discussing that with them. So but yeah, so Harry was like, all right, this is how I'm going to make my money. This is how I'm going to be able, you know, it's like the journalist who, I was just thinking about this the other day, the journalist who really wants to cover Trash Island. So she has to do some like puff celebrity piece before, right? He had to create this enemy in marijuana to get the support for the Federal Narcotics Bureau to attack morphine and opiates. So that's like the beginning kind. Johann Hari talks about that really being the beginning of the war on drugs as we know it in America, and really the beginning of that marijuana propaganda. But as far as, you know, the topic of today's conversation, not only was it the paper industry and Harry Anslinger just being a psycho, but it was also, there was a lot of concern about Latin American immigrants, as a lot of marijuana was starting to come up from Mexico. And so it was kind of, again, that same thing about the Chinese are infecting our women with opium, and now it's Hispanic people and marijuana. But of course, the drugs are going to get there somehow, and we are a country of immigrants. So, but that was really a lot there. Probing questions.
No, but I just think, you know, it's, drugs are like sex. People are going to do it, and teaching them how to do it safely is where we want to go, not punishing people for doing it.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there's some people who are real, you know, who don't like that, but at the end of the day, I'll just say that in the health world and in, you know, substance abuse and mental health, if we don't talk about it, it's still going to happen and the risks are still going to be there. But if we do talk about it and approach different options and find the right option for everyone, we can reduce the risk. So
and also reducing the stigma around mental health and seeking help. That was something. As a child, when my father died, my mom wanted me to go to therapy, and there was such a big part of me that was like, I don't need therapy, I'm not crazy, just because I lost my father, that doesn't mean I'm crazy and need therapy. And I didn't have any success with therapy until I was about 25 or 26 when I seeked it out on my own, when I realized, oh, it's not that I'm crazy, I just need a little help and I need some tools on how to deal with what's going on. And that's all.
Totally.
You're not crazy if you need help from a therapist. So
yeah, thank you for saying that. Absolutely. Because I believe that the majority of substance abuse disorder issues are because of other mental health issues that aren't addressed. I mean, I can pretty much safely say that that was what was going on with me for all that time. And yeah, you're not crazy if you seek mental health services. Life is hard sometimes. And sometimes we need a little bit of support. And in this, you know, increasingly isolated world, we might need to reach out to people to get that support that are outside of our immediate networks. And maybe your boyfriend or your mom or your sister or your kid or your best friend aren't the best people to talk to about how mad they make you, you know? Like, you need a non-biased person. And in this day and age, I mean, I just believe that there is so much universal anxiety out there. Like, if you're just, like, having a really hard time not getting anything done and you just don't know why, you're not the only one. This is a stressful, crazy time to be alive. I think it's exciting, but, you know, a lot of people are struggling right now. And at that same time, therapy has never been more accessible because you can get it on Zoom. Or over the phone.
Totally.
Okay, so back to the history of drug laws. I've just got one more big law that I want to throw at you. But real quick, I discovered something really exciting. I'm pretty well versed in these laws and their history. And I didn't, and obviously I'm not, because I discovered today that in 1969, Timothy Leary actually went to the Supreme Court to take down the Marijuana Tax Act and won. In 1969, the Supreme Court declared that the Marijuana Tax Act of 1937 was unconstitutional based on Timothy Leary's legal proposition. And for those of you who do not know, Timothy Leary is basically known for being like one of the biggest advocates of psychedelic drugs and LSD in American history. And so, yeah, I know who Timothy Leary is, and I thought that was so cool that he brought it down. Unfortunately, in 1970, we see the real beginning of the war on drugs with Richard Nixon and the Controlled Substance Act of 1970.
And that's the war on drugs that we're all really familiar with. Just say no. And
criminal mentality towards drug addiction. And it hasn't worked. It just hasn't worked out very well. There's not great efficacy. And as I was saying earlier, I mean, our prison systems are really in shambles, and there's a lot there for sure. And I think a huge part of that is that the majority of the people in there should be in mental health facilities. But again, those mental health facilities don't really exist either. And so we need to set up a system so that we can release the nonviolent inmates into that system of support, because most of them, a lot of them, are in there for, you know, they're not in there for murder. They're not in there for homicide or whatever. It's a lot of drug arrests, and it's a lot of, you know, a lot of the times people get arrested for, you know, say you're just disorderly in the streets, maybe you're schizophrenic, you know? And so we need to really tie in the mental health rehabilitation into our justice system, because our prisons weren't built to rehab people. They're not built to give people better lives. Anyway, that's a whole nother thing. So the Controlled Substances Act of 1970 is what we still have today, and it's basically what created the drug scheduling system. Now, the drug scheduling system that we have has five schedules, with the Schedule 1 being drugs that have the highest abuse for potential, and basically they have no currently accepted medical use in the United States. Then we go down to Schedule 2, which is high, some accepted medical use. Schedule 3, which is a medium abuse potential that has currently accepted medical use. Then you have your Schedule 4 is your lowest abuse potential, and again, they're used medically. And Schedule 5 has the absolute lowest. So those are drugs like cough syrup, which is interesting, with low amounts of codeine, things that are not for purchase just over the counter, but they're really low in their potential for abuse.
Okay.
So, Kenna, if you were to just guess based on what you know, what do you think, what drugs do you think should be in Schedule 1, the highest abuse potential, no currently accepted medical use in the United States?
Well, I would think alcohol first, just because it is a drug, and I don't know any medical benefits of it. I mean, I guess there are medical benefits if you drink a single glass of wine every night, supposedly that's what we hear, but other than that, I don't really know any.
Yeah, they say one beer a night can be good for hypertension too, but yeah, I mean, really, there's not a lot of medical use. And yeah, and alcohol and tobacco take more lives than almost any other thing in the United States every year. And what do you think should be like at the lowest, Schedule 5? Like, there's no potential for abuse, and there's definitely some medicinal benefits there.
Oh, well, pot.
Marijuana,
would be my first guess, because, well, I'm definitely partial to pot. but I also think that there's been proven to be a lot of medical benefits from it, like you said, with epilepsy and also Parkinson's disease and Huntington's disease, these diseases that are so sad to watch them take people and their their lives.
Yeah, and I like that you bring that up because I recently lost someone in my life to Parkinson's, and we were really trying to get her to use some marijuana products. And one night she finally took, like, it was one of those lozenges or something, and really low dose of marijuana, and it really helped her. But she wouldn't take them because, like, she would never take them again because of, like, that association. You know, she came from a different time, and just her association with marijuana, she wouldn't do it, even though it was something that could have helped her a lot.
I'm curious, what were my scores?
You failed. I'm sorry. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, right? You would think that alcohol, it has the highest abuse potential, and it's not really a medical use thing normally, at least not the kind of alcohol that we drink regularly. It's not on here. Alcohol and tobacco are unscheduled. They're monitored by ATF, the Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms Association. So they have their own branch because that's how much money they make. But it's not considered a drug, which is interesting because they're definitely psychoactive chemicals, obviously, that take a lot of lives. So in our Schedule 1, highest abuse potential, you may not be super surprised that heroin is in there, but you might be a little confused by LSD, DMT, marijuana, peyote, psilocybin, and MDMA, all being in that list. These are the most dangerous drugs, Kenna. These are the drugs that have no medical value and are super, super dangerous and addictive according to our current system.
So I am curious as to why I've never heard that LSD is addictive. What in that substance that makes it addictive? I've just never heard that.
This is just totally, like, based on, you know, I wasn't prepared to answer this question, but just based on what I know. So the government used a lot of LSD and, like, these mind control experiments a while back. Probably before the drug scheduling was created, I think in the 50s
like
and 60s.
Like with Ken
Kesey? Yeah. And all that good stuff. And I'm sorry, I don't want to breeze over that because I know a lot of people don't know, but I just think it's a whole other episode. And I do want to do other episodes that are more about psychedelics, and I'll kind of talk about why in a minute. But basically, all I can tell you is that anytime there is fear that the people can expand their minds and think for themselves and get new ideas outside of this system that's been created for us, the government gets freaked. I mean, I think that that's why I just watched the documentary Waco. It's not a documentary, but, you know, the miniseries on Netflix about Waco. And I just think that that's, like, they get threatened by these charismatic leaders. Not that, like, David Koresh was a good guy or anything. Like, he was a psycho cult leader, but he was a threat to America because he had followers and people were listening to what he said. And I just think that that has a lot to do with also, like, the threat of LSD.
And that threat probably came around in the 60s with the Summer of Love and that kind of stuff, where people were thinking outside the box of, like, maybe we should just love each other and not kill each other.
Yeah.
And so that freaked them out for some reason.
And I think that's important to consider. Well, because the government, I mean, if you look at our war tactics, like, dehumanize the enemy, that's the way that you make it okay. That's how you get police killing people in the streets, is because they don't see them as people. They see them as the enemy. That's how you get people in, you know, militaries across the world killing women and children, is because it's not a person. It's the enemy. And that is just the military mentality. But I think it is really, if you look at the timing of when this happened, this law was created in 1970, and you look at the other stuff on the list, I'm sure there are reasons, but I couldn't really tell you why psilocybin is on that list, or why DMT is on that list, or why MDMA is on this list. They didn't know anything about these drugs back then. And the thing about putting them on this list too, okay, so this is where it gets really crappy. If a drug is in Schedule 1 and declared that there's no currently accepted medical use for it, then they can't study it. they can't study the potential medical use. And they can only, like, I guess, petition to move it out of the schedule if NIDA, the National Institute for Drug Abuse, has done their own studies, but they couldn't do their own. So it gets really funky there with the fact that it's a Schedule I drug. It's like actually repressed the ability to research the actual benefits. That's definitely changed in the past few years as more and more states are decriminalizing. There's more and more studies. There's actually some really interesting marijuana studies happening out at Colorado Mesa University in Grand Junction. Even though they don't have recreational weed in Grand Junction, they're able to study it now. And NIDA too. Like, I mean, this is a little, these is a few years old, but I know that they were growing marijuana for studies and things like that. Now, the FDA, who has like final approval over drugs, right? They have a really messed up system too, where you could have 100 studies that say it doesn't work, but if you have 3 studies that say it does work, that's all we need. We just need those 3 studies. So it's very, between the FDA and NIDA and the DEA and the whole drug scheduling system, it's pretty just crazy how it's all set up. And there's definitely a lot of movement happening.
So this drug scheduling, this is still how drugs are being scheduled. So marijuana is still a Schedule I narcotic?
Federally, yeah. And I was just watching some live PD or whatever, rest in peace, where the cops were like, he's got narcotics on him. And I'm like, what are you talking? Oh, it's Florida. They're in Florida. That's why he's calling it a narcotic. You go to Florida, Arizona, not, I don't think any longer, but I was in Canada, in northwestern Canada, and they were calling it a narcotic. So, yeah, it's technically federally still a narcotic. And that makes it very difficult for those who live in, for those of us who live in a decriminalized state, to understand what the heck is going on in the rest of the country.
Oh, yeah. Well, and I did want to mention again when you were talking about decriminalizing drugs, and people are working to get people who are in jail for marijuana possession in states where it's now legal, they're working to get them out of jail.
That would be great.
Yeah, I mean, and it's crazy to me that there's still people that are in jail from before marijuana was legal in these states. They're still there serving time. Like, I mean, how long ago did pot become legal in Colorado? It was a few years ago. And so to think that there's people still serving time from before it was legal, and we're still trying to get them out of jail.
Well, and in Colorado, there was a 2015 Supreme Court case where a Dish Network employee lost his job because he had a UA. He had to take a urinary analysis, and he had marijuana in his system because he's an epileptic with a medical marijuana card. He lost his job, and he lost the Supreme Court case. So, and that's not even a federal organization. I mean, if you worked for a federal organization like the Forest Service or something like that, you know, it's a little more understandable that you have to adhere to federal regulations, despite how frustrating it is that your local laws are not the same. But there is definitely a lot of movement happening. I know that there was a bill in legislature this year, so who knows what's going on with that, but that was trying to contest that. And there's, and I would love to talk about this on a whole nother episode, because there's a lot happening in psilocybin, MDMA, and ketamine research and their therapeutic value in mental health treatment. And that's happening here in Colorado. So I think that that'll be something really interesting to talk about.
So I love that we're talking about how drug addiction is a mental health issue, and there are drugs that are in the Schedule I narcotics that could help with these mental health issues, but they can't take them because they're Schedule I narcotics, and we can't even do the research on them to figure out the medical and mental benefits of these drugs.
And again, yeah, I get very confused with that. Like, I'm not 100% expert on all of this, because NIDA has been studying marijuana, and there's a guy who's been working really tirelessly to do psilocybin research. And so I actually think that they've moved past stage one. They're in clinical trials for FDA psilocybin research. So that's very exciting. And so somehow they're managing to work beyond it. I mean, I believe that psilocybin was just decriminalized in Denver recently too. And I know that there's a lot of stuff happening, but at the end of the day, this is our federal. This is what the federal law is. So if a state trooper pulled you over or whatever, you know, like, this is the federal law at the end of the day. So moving on, because, yeah, all the psilocybin and stuff like that is very interesting. But also, so this is the scheduling system that basically set it up so that you get more. There's a higher criminal penalty when you're arrested for crack than when you're arrested for cocaine. And crack is basically cocaine that is mixed down into a smokable form. And the big difference there is the cost. Cocaine is much more expensive. And as Whitney Houston once so elegantly said on Barbara Walters, crack is cheap. So
pretty much what you're getting at, if now I'm not going to be able to say this the way I want to. Poor people smoke crack. Rich people do cocaine. There's a worse consequence if you're caught with crack than if you're caught with cocaine.
Absolutely. And the, you know, harsh reality of it is the majority of impoverished people in our nation are people of color. And so it's a pretty racist drug law. And Nixon and the drug scheduling has been really criticized for that a lot. And that's another thing that I think they're trying to overturn, some of those past, you know, charges. These guys are still in jail for these crack possession charges because they got 30 years when if it was in a powder form, they would have gotten, you know, 30 days of probation or whatever it is. I mean, it's pretty stark contrast. I don't know the exact differences off the top of my head, but it was a huge contrast in the amount of time people were getting for crack versus cocaine. And so it was really perceived as targeting inner city blacks and just another tool of oppression.
That is insane.
Yeah, it's crazy. And so I just want to, so now that I've said all that, I just want to give you guys a little bit more of an overview of the drugs that are in these scheduling systems. So again, we have our most dangerous, most highly addictive, heroin, LSD, DMT, marijuana, peyote, psilocybin, and MDMA. Then next, so not as addictive and not as dangerous, you have cocaine, PCP, and methamphetamine. So not as addictive and not as harmful as marijuana or peyote is cocaine, PCP, and methamphetamine. I have to say it again.
It's just weird to me that heroin and coke or crack are in the same scheduling system.
Well, and what this is what weirds me out. So fentanyl is a schedule two. It's below heroin. But what we know is that fentanyl is stronger than heroin. So why is it's like the same drug, but times 50. So why is fentanyl okay to you? That's what I don't really get. Like, we talk about all the obvious reasons why the scheduling system is messed up. I don't get that. And I don't get why where is it? Rufinol is down here in schedule four. Basically, like GHB, I'm trying to find it on this list, but GHB has more medical value than heroin or marijuana. Like, that's crazy to me. GHB is used in the treatment of narcolepsy, but otherwise, like, that's it. Heroin and marijuana actually have like longstanding histories as medicinal drugs.
And GHB is also like a Rufinol. It's what people, what men have used historically to drug people's drinks in order to be able to date rape them.
Yeah, and as we commonly see in the, you know, prescription drug world is like, basically, if you take the drug without the symptom, it'll have the opposite effect. So Rufinol or GHB is used in the treatment of narcolepsy to keep people awake. But people who don't have narcolepsy, yeah, Rufinol will make you pass out. And truly addicted people or people who just really like drugs, you know, none of this matters to them. They'll get high on GHB. They'll shoot up meth. Like, I think that's something that we need to remember, too, is like, yeah, if you have access to the drug and you're a drug user, you're going to do the drug. It doesn't really matter what it is.
Yeah, it doesn't matter, the scheduling system. It doesn't get you high. Yes.
But yeah, I think it's important to address the scheduling system because it's obviously very flawed. It's really old. And if we look at the whole history of our drug laws, like I said in the beginning, regardless of where you stand on addiction and how you feel about sobriety models and all that, our system doesn't really make any sense. It's not really designed to help people. And it's not designed from like a real medical science perspective. It's designed from a racist perspective. It's designed from the perspective of those that seek to control us and seek to keep all the wealth for themselves. So this week's fact of the day is, in addition to the opium poppy being used for at least the past 30,000 years, both recreationally and medicinally by humans, the Sumerians in 4000 BCE referred to it as the joy plant. Although it can have a myriad of negative consequences when used to excess, people have been enjoying the opium plant for as long as we've been around. But I just want to say thank you so much, Kenna, for asking me to come down here and talk about this stuff. It's just so much fun, and I just hope that people enjoy it and learn a lot.
And thank you, Maggie. Thank you for bringing all of these facts and the scientific facts to us, because it just helps reiterate what I already feel about what is going on with our drug laws in our country. And it's so nice to have the facts to back up how I feel about all of this.
Yeah, and that's what I'm here for. You know, trust your gut. If something feels off, it probably is. And just because it's the system that we're used to doesn't mean it's the system that we have to keep. And that's like, it's like we were saying last week with sobriety. You know, it's hard to approach a new life and not know how to do it. It's a whole new set of rules. But, it's the same thing with addiction, and it's the same thing with our government, and it's the same thing with the definition of insanity. You keep trying the same thing over and over again with the same results. Whatever we've been doing hasn't been working for us as individuals in recovery and for us as a nation under this Drug Scheduling Act.
Well said. Thanks again to Maggie for coming in and helping me record this episode of Chemical World. Again, I am your co-host, Kenna Crampton. Be sure to subscribe to Chemical World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter to keep up on Chemical World and what we are up to. Our next episode will air on August 10th. We have our public affairs show that is aired on KDNK at 4:30, and we will continue to offer our extended versions on KDNK.org or on any podcast platform.
And as always, I'm Maggie Seldine, peer recovery coach from MindSprings Health. And if you or someone you know is living with opioid addiction, please call me at 970-531-5060 or email me at mseldine@mindspringshealth.org. That's mseldine@mindspringshealth.org.
Thank you. Take care, everyone.
Stay safe. Drugs may come and drugs may go, and that's all right, you see. Experience has made me rich, and now I can use safely. It might be beer, it might be dope, it may even be caffeine. But we all have a little something that keeps us on our feet. What's important is being safe and stopping the spread of disease. You do not have to be sober to keep your community clean. 'Cause we are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl or boy. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical gender nondescript. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical. We are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl. You know we are living in a chemical world, and I am a chemical girl.